Beers with Chad.
All right, we are here in my backyard. Beers with Chad, episode, Beers with Chad number 8. And today, joined by a guest, my long-time friend, Carlo Valdez. Carlo is a 2018 Olympian in the bobsled, and we're drinking Swami's IPA, courtesy of, cheers, sir.
Cheers.
Courtesy of Pizza Port Brewing down there in Carlsbad, California. Also a fine establishment in San Clemente. You can probably find Anthony Pomponio there at any given day. And so Carlo and I have known each other.
A long time.
From Mariners Christian School here in Orange County. I was looking through an old yearbook today, doing research for the episode. I like to put a lot of research in. So you were in fourth grade, and I was in eighth grade, and Carlo's sister and I went kindergarten through eighth grade. And you were also a member of the prestigious, the illustrious, the dominant Irvine Cougars Track Club. When did you start doing track?
When I was 6 years old, I'm pretty sure. That all started when, I don't know, someone was talking to my dad, and he said, "Hey, your son's pretty fast. You should come out for this track meet." And it was that...
at Newport Harbor, probably.
That one. The Notary Lions Club, whatever it was. Rotary, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And, it was like the city championships, and like there's like three stages. It was like that, the regional, and then like Colt, California.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing like pretty well. I think I won my first couple races. Like for me, it was just the 50, I think.
Yeah.
At that age.
I was also a 50 meter sprinter back in the day.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me, I had no idea what I was doing. It was a dirt track back in those days. that was my first ever like track meet. And then after that, like the official told me and my dad I should, you know, get involved with the track club, but I didn't get involved with the Irvine Cougars until like maybe a few months, maybe a year after that. And that's when it just like kind of took off, you know, from there. And
Irvine Cougars was really fun. So I started doing track about the same age. I think I was a little bit older. I was 8 or 9 years old. And went because my best friend from school was doing it and winning all these races, Kevin Arts. I was just like, oh, I'll go hang out with my friend and do track. And I remember doing the exact same meet that Carlo was talking about at Newport Harbor High School, just down the road on this dirt track, and probably being 8 years old and ran the 50, ran the maybe they had the 100 as well.
Yeah, they
had the softball throw at that for that youngest sub bantam or bantam age group, and then going through that process of city, and then kind of region, and then the Southern California meet at Long Beach State, and I started throwing the shot put still that same year, 8, 9 years old, but also ran the 50, ran the 100, and ran the 4x1. And we were second 1 year and then won the next year. Probably when we were 11, we got second. And then when we were 12, we won whole Southern California 4x100 championship. And this, unsurprisingly, of a team made up of kids from Irvine and Newport Beach.
Mm-hmm.
We were four little white kids. And if you have ever been involved with youth track, every youth track meet is in like downtown LA, Long Beach, and our team was pretty much all white, except our coaches were, and every other team, LA Jets, all these really, kind of youth and like kind of city track clubs. And when we won that 4x1, based pretty much just on having good handoffs and good coaching, because it was a team of me, ended up as a shot putter, and then three guys who ended up being middle and long distance runners.
Mm-hmm.
We just had good handoffs, and my dad told me that when we crossed the finish line, one of the other dads started yelling at his kid, like, "How did you let all them white boys beat you?"
And you hear that a lot, actually. I heard that a lot. You couldn't wear spikes in those meets either.
You get your waffles.
I mean, you can wear spikes in the USATF meets, but for some reason in that separate series they didn't let you wear spikes, and there's people all over the place trying to like cheat the system. Yeah. Oh man.
So started at 6 years old, progressed up modern day high school, discus slash 100 meter star, the rare combination, and then that took you to UCLA. So tell us about your track experience at UCLA.
Yeah, so I mean, I went to UCLA hoping to do my full time in football there and do track on the side. But after that first year, I realized, man, this could be really hard to actually juggle two sports in college. It's
just, who was the head football coach there? Was it still Carl Durrell? Or?
No, Durrell recruited me, and then Neuheisel came in.
Okay.
And I was there for Neuheisel's first year. Neuheisel gave me the go-ahead too.
Were you playing wide receiver? Or?
I was receiver at that time, yeah. So I was already talking to Art too at the time, and he told me, yeah, just come on, walk on, because football was my in there. They got me in through football. I originally had scholarships to Arizona State and Washington State, but because of coaching changes, Washington State, they withdrew their offer from me, and then Arizona State, the receiver coach left, so that was, I mean, for me, I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to go to UCLA. It's a great school.
Yeah.
You know, great history there, tradition, especially with the football and track program. After that first year, I saw a better opportunity with track. And, you know, Art was welcomed me with open arms. And did decathlon that first year. Didn't do that for too long, though, because Art saw me do really well in javelin for that short period of time. And then, unfortunately, Art, they didn't renew his contract after that first year. So in comes Mike Maynard. And
real quick, before we get too far away here, you know, we're saying Art, and most people listening have no idea who we're talking about.
Gotcha.
Describe Art Venegas.
Art Venegas, he's probably one of the most, if not the most legendary throws coach of all time.
John Brenner, John Godina. So those are two of the top five college shot putters of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think both at the time when they threw NCAA record holders.
Yeah.
And just say
Godina.
Yeah, and just an incredible list, top 10. Yeah, if you go to Drake Stadium at UCLA, they had this weight room, and I remember coming up through youth track and seeing this at meets when I was 10 years old, 12 years old, and then in high school at a camp. Going in the weight room there, and they had this top 10 list. Mm-hmm. Shot, disc, hammer, jab, men's and women's, and just legends of collegiate track and field all over this top 10 list. A really, really high standard, particularly in the shot, put, and discus, to get on any of those. And Art Venegas is he's a character.
Yeah.
He's definitely a character.
And that's one of the reasons why he's so legendary. It's not just because of his coaching and his – his record speaks for himself, but he was such a colorful person. Mm-hmm. That would be a great word to describe it. he was just, unique person to be around, and kind of one of a kind. He had so many stories to tell about the past, because he's been doing this for 30 plus years, now probably 40. And he knows so much about, just not just throwing, but weightlifting. Just the small things that make, an athlete successful, to like leading up to an NCAA meet or a world championship meet or an Olympic meet. Like he knows all these ins and outs of what it takes to, reach that next level. And
particularly on the psychology side of things. I think that's maybe what makes him so colorful, mm-hmm. is the psychological, it's bordering somewhere between psychological training and psychological warfare that he puts his athletes through.
Yeah, he really brings the best out of you, or he can bring the worst out of you, depending on how the athlete takes it. And mostly he recruits, or he did recruit, those kind of guys that could take that kind of verbal punishment. He was just in your face all the time. He yelled at you. He made you seem like you're the smallest person in the world. But he would lift you up at the right time. But he was so good at doing that and he brought the best in all those guys.
Was it the kind of thing too where he just is shitting on you for, you know, weeks at a time, months at a time, maybe?
Yeah.
And then when he does give you some compliment, it's like that much more profound, because you're just like, oh my God, he said something good. Like,
yeah, I mean, for most guys, it was more demeaning than it was, you know, praise. But when I was there, it was like he had his good days and his bad days. Like, there'd be like, you know, two or three days where he would just yell at you nonstop and tell you you're just doing terrible, no matter what it was. And then maybe one or two days where he'd be like, oh, that's actually pretty good. But I mean, I love that kind of coaching, and so did all those guys. And, you know, he weeded out, you know, the weak minded athletes, just because there's no room for that in his system, in any system where you're trying to be the best, because you need to have, you know, a strong state of mind in not just collegiate athletics, but, you know, professional sports. But yeah, it's just that kind of attitude drew me to him, as well as other guys, and that's why he's so well known, and why he's coached some of the greatest throwers of all time. It's just, you know, like I said earlier, his record speaks for himself, and his colorful nature and the way he does it, it's funny, but at the same time, like, you have to respond to it and do something with that, and that's what makes his athletes so great.
So you threw under Art, then you threw under Maynard. What was kind of the highlight maybe of your collegiate javelin career?
My highlight was probably, I mean, when I PR'd, just because, you know, I've been working so hard just to get to like a certain point. I mean, collegially, I only threw 215, which was 65 meters, which at the time was on that top 10 list that you were talking about for javelin. So I was pretty pumped to be on that list at the time. I'm gone now because of Derek Eager and Cody Danielson when they came in right after me. But those guys are great throwers. But yeah, going back, definitely PRing, and I kept PRing that my fifth year. Like, I did the 65 and I did 67 in Chula Vista at one of the OTC meets. And that was my best throw in any competition. I mean, I've thrown 70 meters in practice, but that's practice. Anyone can throw far in practice. As throwers know, you know, anyone listening, you always have PRs in practice. But yeah, I mean, I love javelin, but at the same time, I hated it just because of how much I got hurt, and I'm sure others can relate.
Oh yeah, javelin is, I'd say javelin and triple jump are the two just body destroyers of track and field events.
Mm-hmm.
Because the positions, I threw the javelin for 1 year in the Irvine Cougars. Probably like 13 years old. My elbow still hurts from my 1 year of javelin throwing, you know, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's the most contorted, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You run nearly full speed, run down the runway, to then stop all of your momentum in one step on one leg, while your hips turn this way and your shoulder stays back, and you hopefully pull and not drag the spear through the air, and it gets off the point, and now the wind resistance is so much more, and it's just this torqued up, very, very, very tough position from the knee to the back, shoulder, elbow.
Yeah,
it's a tough one on the body for sure.
It hurts thinking about it, honestly. I mean, and it doesn't. It's not one of those things where it sounds worse than it feels. It actually feels worse than it sounds. Because you actually have to contort your body so much to get the most out of the throw. And you're running full speed, stopping on a dime. And if that force coming from, you know, that leg, you know, it's being transferred through your body. And sometimes, actually most of the time for me, it got stopped like in my mid back or upper back. And it just, I had a lot of rib problems.
Yeah. Yeah. My best friend was the Cal school record holder in the javelin. He threw like 74 meters, until Ryan Young broke that.
Yep,
He was a fantastic athlete, very coordinated, you know, explosive guy. Mm-hmm. But his probably best quality for the javelin that he would self-describe himself with is rubbery. He was very rubbery. Yeah. But he had he had two occasions I remember of like subluxed ribs and
Yeah, me too.
That's it's murder on the body. So you have the javelin career, mm-hmm. finish your eligibility at UCLA, and then you kind of just came to this time of I want to keep doing a sport, but javelin is not it.
Yeah, so going back to my coach, came in after Art Venegas, Mike Maynard, he's the one that encouraged not just me, but so my teammate, also while we were there, Andreas Drabal, he was 2 years ahead of me. He told him to go out as well when he graduated. So, and then also adding on to that, Nick Taylor, who was a volunteer assistant at the time, went out with Andreas in 2011, and they both made the team. Like he
went out to a bobsled combine.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, he told him to go out to a combine.
So,
and
what does a bobsled combine consist of?
So it's kind of like an NFL combine, but just way less complex. So instead of a 40, we actually ran back then a 60. And we were given scores for our first 15, our first 30, our flying 30 through the 15 and 45 meter eye, and the full 60. So that's four scores right there. And then, so it's possible 800 points total.
So you have like a decathlon type of scoring table associated with this?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then
something that they've derived for that.
Mm-hmm. And then the other four components that were evaluated were the one rep max in clean and jerk, not clean and jerk, just clean, sorry, which in the max score was 150 kilos, and then the three rep max in back squat, which was 200 kilos, was max, and then standing broad, and the max score there was 3.3 meters, so was that like 11?
Yeah, like 11
and a half.
Yeah.
11 and a half feet standing broad. So, like, these are like no joke scores. And we have guys that jump 3.5 meters. And then the last one is underhand shot toss with a 16 pound shot. And the max score you can get is throwing, I want to say, 60 feet.
Yeah, about 18 and a half meters.
Yeah.
Yeah, all very strong results. So how big are you?
So most of my time in bobsled, I'm 6'2", and I kind of range between 220 and 230 pounds.
So really what they're looking for in bobsled is the biggest, strongest, fastest person mm-hmm. they can find, because it's a very, I won't say simple, but very straightforward sport.
Yeah, very straightforward.
Get a bunch of guys who are big, strong, and fast to push this down the mm-hmm. ice, and then one guy to drive them,
mm-hmm.
drive them down there. So these guys went to the combine. They did well. Maynard encouraged you to check out bobsled as well.
Yeah. So after they did well, and then we found out, you know, later down the line, the next winter they made the national team, and Mike Maynard said, hey, if they can make it, then you can make it. So, 2 years later, I decided I didn't want to work. I took his advice and went out for a combine. I actually did a combine almost right away. But that was the Olympic year for Sochi. So mm-hmm. I did good, but it wasn't enough to give me a look for that Olympic year, because bobsled's not solely focused, but a huge part of it is experience, and I had no experience. So I mean, they're not really weren't gonna take a chance on me or anyone for that matter going into the Olympic year especially. So once I learned that and realized, okay, I got the next year, and you know, I still want to continue to do this, I trained the whole next year, did another combine, did better, and then that led me to rookie push champs. Did well at rookie push champs. I mean, it's just another way to evaluate a potential in a pusher. And then,
What happens at Rookie Push Champs? Sled, is this the sled put, like, you load up a prowler and it's time to the fucking prowler push championships or what?
Not exactly, actually. Yeah. So we have a dry land push track in Lake Placid, so it's just pretty much a bobsled on wheels. So, I mean, we can't maintain an ice year-round on the tracks, so
is global warming is working against the bobsled
team? Sledding season's only so long, so we have to resort to, dry land stuff, and that's our way to, that's our sport specific right there, pretty much our only way. And there's an ice house actually in Calgary, that's the only indoor ice house facility in North America where we can push a sled on ice that simulates a start. It's not an actual real track, it's just a track. Like 120 meters that simulates a start. Goes, you push it, goes down, and then it goes up to stop it, and then it comes back, and you push it up back to the start for the next person. So we only hold push champs in Calgary only like for the years leading up to the Olympics and Olympic year. But for years like after the games, like they'll probably do the push champs in Lake Placid on that dryland push track. So that's what we did for our rookie camp that year. So it's just a week of you becoming familiar with the technique, becoming comfortable pushing behind a sled, not just from the brakes, but from both sides. And, you know, being able to adapt to a different technique. Because, I mean, yeah, you're running, but there's so much more that goes into it, pushing a sled. Like, you have to maintain pressure on the bar. You have to make sure your hips are underneath you. Otherwise, like, all your force is going, you know, it's not being transferred properly, I should say. And
it's not just who is the fastest necessarily. It's who's the fastest pushing a sled. Yeah. Like every other sport, it is about doing the sport, not just the general qualities around it.
Exactly. You got guys that come out who are just freaks and they're just really good off the bat. And they just hit a plateau almost immediately because they just don't register how to be faster, be better. They just think they're really good and that's it. But there's the guys like myself, that's how I actually became, I rose up the ladder. Like I developed and I figured out ways to improve here and there and just try to, you know, get the best out of myself in every aspect that there was with technique and all the angles and all that stuff. So
I think that's what, you know, technique and angles is what's the difference of someone who's just a great 60 meter sprinter to someone who can transfer that power into the sled. Because I've even seen this, you know, playing football in high school or throwing the shot put, is, you know, that I was bigger, stronger, faster than some people, but certain people just had the ability to connect, you know, through the power in their hips or whatever it was. But when they hit the sled, you know, a football, like a blocking sled, they just made it go more so than you would expect, you know, beyond their physical abilities. Or they just connect power into an implement, into a shot put, into a discus, into a med ball, into a pud, whatever it was that they were going to throw. They just had this ability to connect power into that. And there's a similar special strength skill to bobsled.
Yeah, because you got guys who are, like I said earlier, they're freaks and their numbers are off the charts, combine numbers off the charts, but for some reason they can't translate that into a sled for whatever reason. And then you got guys who are just average at a combine but are just amazing pushers. It's really weird, but at the same time it makes sense because some people just get it and know how to translate what they have into the sled, and there's other guys that just, there's a disconnect. And
you guys get much involvement with like real sports science kind of stuff for bobsled?
Yeah,
you deal with like force plates, high speed cameras, different kind of biomechanists, anything like that?
Yeah, we actually have these sensors. So Omega has these sensors that they put on our sleds, and they measure the velocity, the G's, all that stuff, and the speeds. You know, we get this through this graph that's portrayed, and especially in pushing, you just see this, because obviously it's not going to be a straight line, because you're pushing all at once, and there is some your feet,
yeah, your feet aren't constantly on the ground applying force.
Exactly. So. Yeah, you're not applying force at all times. So you see that chart, but the whole point of it is to making sure that it's going up.
Mm-hmm.
So we can take a close look at that and see where, like, we're messing up, or see what we're good at, or see where our weaknesses are at, and especially on the load. That's also another important area. It's not just about the push. It's about how efficient you are at the push and how good you're at maintaining that velocity getting in the sled. Because you got guys who can push really fast,
mm-hmm.
but they have terrible velocity when they get in the sled and they just lose all their time. And I was talking about this earlier, but having speed at the top of the track is so important, because you can easily lose a race at the top of the track if you don't have that speed, more so than if you lose speed at the bottom of the track. So you need as much speed as possible at the top, so you can be that much faster at the bottom. So loading the sled, you have to be quiet, smooth, efficient, no jerking motions. Everything has to be just, you know, forward.
Do you guys spend a lot of times like all jumping into bathtubs in the line together?
Yeah, not necessarily bathtubs, but we do dry loads. We call that dry loading. And yeah, we'll just have the sled in our scabbards.
What is a scabbard?
It protects the, it's like a runner guard. It protects the runners.
What's a runner guard?
so the blades that you see that we go on the ice with?
Yeah, yeah.
Those are called runners. And they're not sharp.
I saw a movie once, and the bolt holding that in was loose.
Yeah, that's poor equipment.
You make sure to avoid that.
Really poor equipment, man. that would never happen. Actually, that has happened in a race. But, man, people get pissed when that happens. I bet. A huge fine.
Like, didn't you fucking learn anything from Cool Runnings? Tighten the goddamn bolt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's to me, it's unbelievable. Because we have nuts, too. And if you can't grasp that, it's so simple. Like, you should be kicked off a team.
Uh-huh.
There's no room for that. But yeah, so we're on these runners. They're not sharp. They're actually they're round, anywhere between 4 millimeter and a 7 millimeter radius. But they're really delicate and really fragile. We don't want them to get scratched up or anything. And like for practice, it really doesn't matter. We sand with high grits just to make sure scratches are out. And the runner just looks like a normal piece of metal, honestly. But for races, we want the runner to be shiny, so we polish it, we sand it, and to get all the scratches out, then we polish it, so it looks like a mirror. So, you know, it looks almost like, you know, this can, you know,
is it
really,
now,
really shiny.
Now, is this just for the look or for the performance of it? Okay.
Yeah, there's a certain satisfaction with the look.
Look good, play good.
Yeah, for the races, we get them to be, you know, perfectly shiny, good to go.
Flossing.
Yeah, flawless. But we don't put those runners on until we get to the top of the track for races. But for practice and stuff, we put them in the scabbards. And then after our first heat in the race, we put them in scabbards. Anytime the sled has runners on and it's flipped, like, right side down, we need those scabbards. So going back to the dry loads, we have a stationary sled, and we're practicing loading a lot into the sled to make sure that we're in sync and that we're as efficient as possible, because any little slip, any mishap, you know, that's small, precious hundredths.
Yeah, and that's the game, hundredths of a second.
Hundredths of a second, yeah.
So you get in, you do the combine, you do all this stuff. You eventually become on the national team. I know you guys are going through different phases, competition, non-competition, everything, but. You know, a week in the life, example week in the life of a national team bobsledder. I guess first we've established what makes you good at bobsledding. Mm-hmm. Biggest, strongest, fastest person possible who can transfer power into the sled, who's smooth loading into the sled. So your mm-hmm. training is going to be focused on what? What are kind of the go-to lifts? How many times a week are you sprinting? How many times a week are you pushing? How many times a week are you lifting?
So I'll break down both off-season and in-season. In the off season, most of us train 5 to 6 days a week. And then the way I break it up, So I'll do 3 to 4 days of lifting, mainly four actually. So I'll have two lower body / full body days, and then two upper body days. But on those two upper body days, I sprint or push, maximum all out, whether if it's pushing for a certain amount distance or sprinting. You know, I'll sprint anywhere between 120 meters, 90 meters now actually, to 20 to 30 meters. It just depends on the day and how much load I want to put on myself.
So when you're getting out in those longer distances, when you actually push the sled on the track, that's mm-hmm. 10 meters, 20 meters?
So from the starting block to the first eye is 15 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to be the flat part of the track. And then usually, give or take, either before or after the 15-meter mark, that's when you hit the crest and when it starts going downhill. And then from there, it's about 15 to 25 more meters.
Okay, so you actually could push maybe 35 to 40 meters?
Oh, yeah.
But as you're getting out into that longer 90-120 stuff, is that just like speed endurance towards having a better work capacity for more quality training?
That's only off season.
Yeah.
Definitely work capacity, and especially for combine training, that's what I used to do, because we trained for the 60.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go double the distance just to, you know, cover my bases. But now it's only a 45, so now I only go 90. That's the furthest I'll go. And then on the days that I'm not lifting, are the days I'm doing my tempo stuff, which I'm also building more work capacity. So I'll be doing like 150s or 200s at a constant buildup. So I'll go like, I'll start at like 50% for the first 50, then I go 60% the next, and then 70 and 80. I'll end at 80.
Yeah.
Depending on the distance.
So it's a tempo run, Charlie Francis kind of idea, about 60 to 75% effort.
Yep.
Yeah, for these over distances, for an aerobic capacity development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, the training volume that I have in the off season is a lot. So any little bit helps, especially these tempo days, not just to gain, you know, a little more work capacity, but at the same time give my legs a nice little active recovery, because they're dead some days. I mean there's also those days where you just need a complete day off because fatigue sets in and you don't want overtraining to happen, because it sets you back. So I mean, luckily over the years, I mean, working with Art Venegas with my programming, like those days have decreased pretty good. Like there'd be maybe 4 or 5 days in the off season where I was fatigued and had to take days off. And then this past off season, I only had 1 or 2 days where I was fatigued and had to take a day off. Yeah. So,
and I think that's the thing too with, you know, when I was throwing or doing stuff with bobsled, sprinting, you know, weightlifting, where it's not just strength qualities, but also the speed and technique qualities. Yeah. And it all has to come together, you know, so synergistically for this really great effort. Mm-hmm. It becomes such a more fine line you have to walk of fatigue management. Like powerlifting is like you're going in shooting a shotgun, like you could feel shitty, but you can still hit the target. As you get to these really fine high velocity qualities, you have to manage fatigue so much better. And when that really became apparent to me when I continued to try and throw the shot put after I'd started Juggernaut. Mm-hmm. And you know, before I was going to class and lifting and throwing, and now it became working, lifting and throwing, and the working was so much more stressful to me. Even though the hours weren't that much more necessarily, it was the fatigue just from that kind of stress and being on your feet all day at work and everything that I'd go out and throw, and I was just like, my body wasn't tired, but my mind was tired, and that made it tough. So you're doing the sprint work, all these different phases. How about weightlifting? Obviously, the clean is something that's tested in the combine. Mm-hmm. What's your weightlifting training looking like?
So, in the off season, I do for 6 weeks. I do what's called a 10-day cycle. So that means I extend my week by 5 more days just to give myself more rest in between those main core lifting days. So normal week for someone is Monday, Wednesday, Friday. For me, it was Monday, Thursday, Monday. And then the new week would start the following Thursday or that Thursday after the Monday. So that's just to give my body more time to recover from the 6x6s that I'm doing, you know, 5x5s, and just like mixing and matching with multiple core lifts a day. So like one day, I'll give you an example, I would do like 6x6 back squat at a fixed weight, all at the same weight. And like I would do like 160, 170 for all six of those sets, which is just hurts thinking about it. And then I would switch to a pause front squat, and I would do that for 3x6. And obviously I lower the weight, but like doing a double squat day, and I do that actually twice in that 10-day period. So I'll do the back squat to a pause front squat variation, and then I'll do a front squat to a pause back squat variation. And it's just the ultimate I hate my life scenario, because you just absolutely crush your body, and you're wondering how your body's dealing with it, but you wake up the next day and you can't walk. Like, I can barely walk out of there. You can just feel your legs swell up and stuff like that. It's just, it's hell. And that middle day is a pull day. So whether it's, we like to do trap bar deads now just to take the stress off the back from all the other stuff. And I mean, there's one workout hour makes me do, and it's like a 3x6. No, sorry. It's a 3x4, 3x5, and then a 1x6. He makes me do one extra set of six at the end of the fours and the fives. And I have to either maintain the weight or go up for that set of six.
All right, it's a real dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's usually what my 10-day cycle looks like. And then after like those deadlifts, my pull days turn into obviously clean pulls, normal cleans. I do power cleans. I do power snatch. I can't catch below parallel, just the way my body's made. I don't know why. But anyway, I keep everything out of power movement just because I keep my hamstrings involved as much as possible.
What are your best results in the lifts?
So my best power clean is 160 kilos. My best power snatch is 115. I've had a 120 multiple times, but I couldn't maintain it. Best bench, 175 kilos. Best squat, 235. Yeah, 235. And then best front. Actually, I don't test my front. It's only in the off season.
What about in some sprinting and jumping kind of stuff? If you had to make a guess at what, if you were going to run a 40,
in my opinion, I can easily run anywhere in the 4.3 range.
Yeah.
Right now, yeah. No matter what.
Vertical jump?
Vertical, we actually tested it for fun. And I think, I mean, my best previous was like 37.5.
When you say best previous, like best previous when you were doing...
When I was like in college.
In track in college, yeah.
37.5, and I think it was about the same. So, I mean, it might have been 38, but I just never tested for that kind of thing. It's just for fun.
So 6'2", 225, 38-inch vertical.
Yeah, and then my deadlift was... I mean, I did a 300-kilo trap bar dead.
I remember, not this Olympics, but 2014 Olympics, there was a guy, a bobsledder, Steve something maybe?
Steve Langton.
Monster box jumper. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll show this. Yes. Yeah, so Steve Langton, yeah, he's one of those freak athletes that translated insanely well to bobsled. Like he's probably like considered one of the best pushers of all time in like the world. Not just the USA, like, cause he's, so we call him Nitro, push track hero. Just because he was, you know, back when he was going full time, like he was insane. Like he was really, really good. And we'd always like his push video was our was like our default. Like that was the video that we looked at to try to be the best as possible and try to emulate that.
That's bobsled and, pushing porn.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it was awesome to see him come back out this year and be on the team with us. And he still had it. He still had the same push ability. And it was for me, it was really, really cool to be able to be teammates with him and push with him and compete with him. So, but yeah, his lifts and his box jump, man, he had a...
It was like 70 inches.
70-inch running box jump, yeah.
Well, so... You do all this stuff. You get to the Olympics, 2018 Olympics. Tell me about maybe a highlight of your experience at the Olympics this year.
I'll say it again. I've said it multiple times. The opening ceremonies, just walking out behind the American flag with all my teammates and all the other Team USA athletes into the stadium. You know, packed house, sold out, obviously, and you know not just that, but everyone back home watching, everyone in the world watching. From all these nations, you know, just watching us walk out. And then, after being able to do that, we got up to the stands. And, you know, after watching all the other nations come out, we were able to see South Korea and North Korea come out under one flag, which was, like, you know, one of those moments you'll never forget because it just, one, like, people told us it was going to happen, but you couldn't prepare yourself for how it was going to be, like what the reaction was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so everyone knew what was happening. Everyone knew what was going on. Everyone stood up. It was like this big like moment. And like, yeah, they came out under the one flag and it was a powerful moment for me. I'm sure for a lot of other people, just because like there's so much stuff going on in the world right now, especially between them two. And yeah. It's just like,
made you feel like you were doing something more than pushing a sled down some ice.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, you know, the Olympics are so much more than just sport and competition. It's about bringing the world together. So that was a really powerful moment for me and a favorite moment as well.
So
and
I remember as the Olympics were going, there was all these, yeah, I'd see these BuzzFeed articles or whatever about like, you know, the 10 hottest Olympians, and the men's bobsled team they were really heavily featured.
Yeah, we were. Yeah,
I mean, that had to be. Yeah, I've heard a lot about the Olympic Village, always referencing the Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
But if that same kind of thing is going on in the Winter Olympics, that had to serve you pretty well.
It did. but yeah, all those articles, like, so all this like was stemming from. So, first of all, like all of our accounts started blowing up like a month prior to the games.
Mm.
But for a different reason. So we were featured on a Reddit forum, a gay Reddit forum.
Oh.
And our team photo from the past year made it on there.
Uh-huh.
And from there, like it went really viral. And like not just with them though, like all of a sudden we get all these like followers, like.
So you decided with that handlebar mustache you had, I'm like, I'm just really going to lean into this.
Well, I mean, that's always been a look of mine. It just happened to be so finally appreciated.
When the men's bobsled team obviously dresses up as the village people for Halloween, you're the biker, right?
Now, I mean, it really depends on what I'm going for. You know, you can really play around with some options, but yeah, I mean, we got that it went crazy with, you know. The women, the men, like it was so mixed, and we just kept seeing our picture like here, there, there, here, there, and then all of a sudden like the top 10 lists, top 20 lists, whatever you want to call it, like I made like the Olympics top 12 or top 20 bulge list. I made like top 10 like good looking men list.
The
like,
bobsled uniform really lends itself to that. Do you stuff your bobsled?
No.
Unitard.
No. I don't fluff it either.
Okay.
Some people fluff.
Oh. I'm not going to hate on any of that. No. that's your moment. That's your moment to shine. You got to put your best foot forward.
Yeah,
figuratively.
Exactly. You got to do what you can. And then people finally were starting to realize like my last name is Valdez and I'm half Hispanic. So all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, the Latino crowd involved.
They're like, this guy is one of the, there's only like five minorities at the whole Winter Olympics. Yeah. Let's latch on to this one.
Yeah, so like all these news articles were popping up. I was getting like interviewed during the games, like on a phone call. Like I'd have to wake up like at 7-8 o'clock in the morning just to take these phone calls because it's like nighttime for them. So I'm like, it was kind of hard doing that, but at the same time I enjoyed it because it's a nice little distraction to take your mind off things, which is really important. You can't just be, you know, in whatever you're doing or bobsled. You gotta take your mind off and kind of take in the whole Olympic experience. So I mean, yeah, like stuff like that and social media, it helps, but in doses, obviously. So yeah, all that press from the Latino crowd, that became popular with me, and yeah, just bobsled as in general as a sport, we were getting a lot of notoriety for, you know, us being men in spandex.
So there's a strong, fast, you know, football player, baseball player, rugby player, whatever out there, track guy watching this. You know, how would you encourage him towards bobsled? And besides the obvious sales pitch of you could also end up on like a gay fetish Reddit forum.
Yeah, I mean, besides that, I mean,
if you need any more motivation,
I think the draw, there should be more of a draw just because, I mean, for me and for anyone actually, I mean, bobsled is word of mouth. Like you only hear about it if someone tells you to do it. So now, I mean, we're starting to realize, okay, development needs to be better for our sport. And for me, like it'd be easy just to go out and say, hey, look, like you run a 10-3, you know, you probably like hit a ceiling as far as track goes. You can either waste money doing track or you can try out bobsled and potentially have what it takes to make a national team and not have to pay for that much.
Yeah, you get to travel the world and
yeah. I mean, obviously it can't be a twig. I mean we tend to, I mean, there's guys that come out who are, you know, really really fast, but they're only 180 pounds and they can't push a sled because there's no force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe they can excel at being a four guy in a four-man sled because like the sled's taken off already for them. All I gotta do is run with it, and that's we found that's actually, you know, really really good, but there's only so many slots for that. So once people realize that, the ones who are serious, they gain the weight, and those speed demons turn into, like, you know, guys who are like 200 pounds 210 pounds. So that's more ideal for a speedster. Like if you're really really fast, like, and you know it, like me, if a guy were to come out, I'm like, man, you're way faster than me. Just as long as you get to 200 pounds, that's good enough. And then you'll continue to develop over the years, obviously, if you stick with it. But prototypically, yeah, we want guys, you know, anywhere between 6 foot, 6'3", 210 to 230 pounds who are fast. I mean, that's the name of the game. You can be too strong, but you can never be too fast is what we say. So being stronger than you need to be will probably inhibit you. But, you know, we want speed. And if you happen to be within that weight range, that's just a plus for us because that's money.
All right. Where can they follow you on social media?
So I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. On Twitter and Instagram, I'm CarloValdez_USA. And Facebook, Carlo Valdez USA, and all that stuff's just shared from my Instagram. My Instagram page is the main hit, so yeah, check me out on there.
So that's a Latino, you know, Latin lover, Latino heartthrob, doesn't even have to stuff his bobsled speed suit. Carlo Valdez, Orange County's right. Own Newport Beach's finest. Another episode of Beers with Chad. Follow, subscribe to the Jug Life podcast on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and thejuglife.com. If you're interested in online coaching, juggernautcoaching.com for powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, strongman, and power building. Carlo, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers to the Irvine Cougars.
Irvine Cougars, yeah.
Team USA.
And Team USA.
You're big, strong, and fast like this. You could be slaying in the Olympic Village, too.
Yeah. Awesome.